If only it were Chadwick by Louis Buss, Part 4. The scrutiny of the handwritten inscriptions found in a 1935 edition of the book Self-Realization, bought on eBay, takes the author on a journey of inspiration and expectation. Continued from the November-December 2011 issue. One of us. For who could fail to love old Chadwick? It's the sheer size of the man, the mixture of gentleness, strength, and that certain endearing shyness. It's his luminous kindness and that boyish enthusiasm which so often seems to have led him into a sort of clumsiness. But above all, we love him because of his own absolute and unswerving love for Bhagwan. He may not have been a great scholar or poet, and he may have put his size 13 foot in it from time to time, but he had that unthinking adoration and trust which are all a devotee really needs. The moment he first arrived in the ashram, all his best and worst qualities were on display. As he hastened to prostrate before Anamali Swami, apparently on the assumption that the first Indian he set his eyes on would have to be Bhagwan, when he was taken to the hall and introduced to the real Bhagwan, that same boyish eagerness asserted itself again as he launched in with his first question about why Christ had cried out on the cross, then kept Bhagwan talking for hours, blissfully unaware that he was offending all the other devotees by remaining seated on a chair. Bhagwan himself, of course, was not offended any more than he was on the occasions when he visited Chadwick's room, and far from getting up to welcome him, Chadwick remained seated and carried on with what he was doing. In some superficial ways, Chadwick seems to have been ill-suited to ashram life, and perhaps it is this that most endears him to me. He couldn't sit cross-legged, but was so determined to meditate in Bhagwan's presence that he was prepared to strap himself up in that ridiculous cotton belt. From what one can gather, he didn't sink then into deep samadhi for hours on end. Despite the fact that he had devoted his life so wholeheartedly to Bhagwan, he found it very awkward to prostrate before him in public, and resisted doing so for as long as he could. It must be difficult for any Indian to understand just how reassuring a rather conventional Englishman like me finds it to know that such a figure was there, so close to Bhagwan and at the center of the ashram in so many ways. Not only had Chadwick trodden this foreign road before me, but he had remained perfectly sane, eminently practical, and, in a strange way, reassuringly English. If I find it hard to express my gratitude to Chadwick, I find it even more difficult to express my gratitude to Bhagwan for loving him as he did, for accepting him just as he was, and for doing so in such a very public way. For in accepting Chadwick, Bhagwan was somehow accepting and welcoming all we clumsy Westerners. His open declaration that Chadwick was an Indian who had had some desire to be reborn in the West, but that they had been together before, was really quite remarkable, especially as Bhagwan almost never revealed anything about people's previous incarnations. I do not for a moment flatter myself that He might have said anything similar about me. All the same, whenever I think of him declaring that Chadwick was one of us, I can't help feeling that in some way he meant the reassurance to apply to other Westerners as well. The fact is, and as I know, I am about to reveal my own abysmal lack of spiritual development, that I am just ever so slightly proud of Chadwick when I read about him defending Bhagwan against that visiting missionary, intervening in his stentorian voice to correct his reading of the Bible. I can't help feeling he was somehow thundering on my behalf as well. I take a particular boyish delight in that silly game he played of using the fan, then pretending he hadn't been doing so the moment Bhagwan turned round. And because Chadwick is part of me, I am somehow personally flattered that Bhagwan took it all in such good part. Similarly, I take ridiculous pride in the fact that my Chadwick is one of the few people I can think of whom Bhagwan specifically named as having appeared in one of his dreams. Whenever I read of some little triumph like that, an unenlightened part of me wants to punch the air as if my team has just scored a goal and cry, "Good old Chadwick." None of this, I hope, gives the impression that I think Chadwick was at my own humble level of development. This is a man, let us remember, who had worked out for himself the basic principles of Advaita and the technique of self-inquiry before he had ever heard of Bhagwan, an extraordinary achievement by anyone's standards. He was the first devotee of any nationality who was allowed to build himself a home inside the ashram and settle there permanently. This clumsy Englishman, who couldn't even cross his legs, was also the one who eventually assumed responsibility for reinstating the Sri Chakra Puja at the mother's shrine and reviving the Veda Patasala after Bhagwan's death. These are sacred trusts, and if Chadwick was the one who ended up bearing them, it can only be because Bhagwan knew he was the best person for the job. The fact that I can so easily imagine myself pumping Chadwick's hand and slapping him on the back is perhaps less an indication that he was down on my level than a testimony to the simplicity and humility of a man in a high spiritual state. Perhaps that was why he recognized Bhagwan so quickly, went to him without the least hesitation, and never seems to have felt the slightest desire to see anybody else. It's hard to imagine good old Chadwick indulging in a dalliance with Aurobindo, Papa Ramadas, or Krishnamurti, or even feeling a compelling need to set eyes on Gandhi. In this, he almost bears comparison with the adoring Muruganar himself, although I do seem to remember that Chadwick once left Bhagwan's presence to go on a trip somewhere, and Muruganar always refused to do even that. Chadwick also shares with Muruganar, and indeed with all Bhagwan's foremost devotees, the distinction of never having been tricked into believing he might be some sort of guru himself. For those who have recognized Ramana Maharishi understand that there is only one guru they or anyone else will ever need. Yes, I wanted it to be Chadwick, a book that had been sent from the ashram to England in 1936, was clearly a treasure. But knowing it had been sent by Chadwick would make it priceless in my eyes. At first glance, it seemed the odds were in my favor. A Search in Secret India, the Paul Brunton book which first spread Bhagwan's fame in the West, had only come out in 1934. Before that, as far as I knew, there had been no English visitors since Humphreys in the early part of the century. Our mystery devotee must have been one of the very first to pack his bags and set off in search of this intriguing Maharishi. The fact that he could describe Tiruvannamalai as the place in which I am living must have made him one of a very small group indeed. The dates fitted well. Chadwick arrived at the ashram in November 1935. By the time the book was sent in August of the following year, he would have been living there for 9 or 10 months, long enough to get into that pleasant routine of visiting the temple for meditation at the shrine of Krishna, then walking back through the forest archway for an evening in the old hall. Perhaps it had also been long enough for him to start looking on the place as home and to realize that he might never return to England. Could it have been this great realization that prompted him to send the book back to his parents? If it now seemed that he might never see them again, he would have wanted to do everything in his power to make them understand the reason for his decision, which might have seemed to them at best foolish and at worst traitorous. There might already have been an exchange of letters between India and England in which he explained his decision and they remonstrated with him, and that would certainly fit with the tone of the dedication on the opening page. Sending the book might have been his last-ditch attempt to make them understand. Surely, once they had actually seen Bhagwan's picture and read some of his teachings, Chadwick's parents would appreciate why their son could never now leave his side. But if the dates fitted perfectly, and though Chadwick had been one of a very few Westerners in the ashram at the time, there were other incongruities that made me uneasy. The first and most obvious was the idea of Chadwick having parents alive at all. There is no mention of them in A Sadhu's Reminiscences. As far as I could remember, Chadwick there describes having a farewell stay with his sisters before he set off for India, not his parents. A quick look back at the opening of the book confirmed that this was right. Then, thanks to the wonders of modern technology, I was able to search the entire text at the press of a button and discover that there was not one mention of anybody called Russell. The mystery devotee had a mother, a father, and what looked very much like a brother. These people were still alive and still loomed so large in his life that he had taken the trouble to send them a book from India in an attempt to make them understand why he had moved there. But the Chadwick of A Sadhu's Reminiscences, if his parents are still alive, doesn't even deem them worth a mention. He doesn't tell us how they reacted to his decision to leave, or describe any scene of farewell. The fact that he does specifically mention saying goodbye to his sisters had naturally led me to assume, on previous readings of the book, that his parents were dead and that those sisters were the only family he had left to see him off. continued in the next issue.